This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Ted DeLorme in Fort Mill, South Carolina, during July and August 2006. Love Conquers All by Robert C. Benchley. The remainder of this book is subtitled The Literary Department, and contains Benchley's reviews of books, plays, etc. Chapter 36. Take Along a Book.
There seems to be a concerted effort, manifest in the Take Along a Book drive, to induce vacationists to slip at least one volume into the trunk before getting Daddy to jump on it. This is a fine idea, for there is always a space between the end of the tennis racket and the box of soap in which the shoe whitening is liable to tip over unless you jam a book in with it. Any book will do. It is usually a book that you have been meaning to read all spring, one that you have got so used to lying about to people who have asked you if you have read it that you have almost kidded yourself into believing that you really have read it. You picture yourself out in the hammock or down on the rocks with a pillow under your head and pipe or a box of candy near at hand, just devouring page after page of it. The only thing that worries you is what you will read when you have finished that. Oh, well, you think, there will probably be some books in the town library. Maybe I can get Gibbon there. This summer will be a good time to read Gibbon through. Your trunk doesn't reach the cottage until 4 days after you arrive, owing to the ferry pilot's strike. You don't get it unpacked down as far as the layer in which the book is until you have been there a week. Then the book is taken out and put on the table. In transit, it has tried to eat its way through a pair of tramping boots, with the result that one corner and the first 20 pages have become dog-eared, but that won't interfere with its being read. Several other things do interfere, however. The nice weather, for instance. You start out from your room in the morning and, somehow or other, never get back to it except when you are in a hurry to get ready for meals or for bed. You try to read in bed one night, but you can't seem to fix your sunburned shoulders in a comfortable position. You take the book down to luncheon and leave it at the table. And you don't miss it for 3 days. When you find it again, it has large blisters on page 35 where some water has dropped on it. Then Mrs. Beatty, who lives in Montclair in the wintertime, no matter where you go for the summer, you always meet some people who live in Montclair in the winter, borrows the book, as she has heard so much about it. 2 weeks later, she brings it back and explains that Prince got hold of it one afternoon and chewed just a little of the back off, but says that she doesn't think it will be noticed when the book is in the bookcase. Back to the table in the bedroom it goes, and is used to keep unanswered postcards in. It is also convenient as a backing for cards which you yourself are writing. And the flyleaf makes an excellent place for a bridge score if there isn't any other paper handy. When it comes time to pack up for home, you shake the sand from among the leaves and save out the book to be read on the train, and you leave it in the automobile that takes you to the station. But for all that, take along a book. It might rain all summer.
Chapter 37. Confessions of a Chess Champion. With the opening of the baseball season, the sporting urge stirs in one's blood, and we turn to such books as My Chess Career by J.R. Capablanca. Mr. Capablanca, I gather from his text, plays chess very well, wherein he unquestionably has something on me. His book is a combination of autobiography and pictorial examples of difficult games he has participated in and won. I could understand the autobiographical part perfectly, but although I have seen chess diagrams in the evening papers for years, I have never been able to become nervous over one. It has always seemed to me that when you have seen one diagram of a chessboard, you have seen them all. Therefore, I can give only a superficial review of the technical parts of Mr. Capablanca's book. His personal reminiscences, however, are full of poignant episodes. For instance, let us take an incident which occurred in his early boyhood, when he found out what sort of man his father really was. A somber event in the life of any boy, much more so for the boy Capablanca. "I was born in Havana, the capital of the island of Cuba," he says, "the 19th of November, 1888. I was not yet 5 years old when, by accident, I came into my father's private office and found him playing with another gentleman. I had never seen a game of chess before. The pieces interested me, and I went the next day to see them play again. The third day, as I looked on, my father, a very poor beginner, moved a knight from a white square to another white square. His opponent, apparently not a better player, did not notice it. My father won, and I proceeded to call him a cheat and to laugh. Imagine the feelings of a young boy entering his father's private office and seeing a man whom he had been brought up to love and to revere moving a knight from one white square to another. It is a wonder that the boy had the courage to grow up at all with a start in life like that. But he did grow up, and at the age of 8, in spite of the advice of doctors, he was a frequent visitor at the Havana Chess Club. As he says in describing this period of his career, "Soon Don Celso Golmayo, the strongest player there, was unable to give me a rook." So you can see how good he was. Don Celso couldn't give him a rook. And if Don Celso couldn't, who on earth could? In his introduction, Mr. Capablanca — I wish that I could get it out of my head that Mr. Capablanca is possibly a relation of the Casablanca boy who did the right thing by the burning deck. They are, of course, two entirely different people. In his introduction, Mr. Capablanca says, "Conceit I consider a foolish thing, but more foolish still is that false modesty that vainly attempts to conceal that which all facts tend to prove. It is this straining to overcome a foolish false modesty which leads him to say, in connection with his matches with members of the Manhattan Chess Club, 'As one by one I mowed them down without the loss of a single game, my superiority became apparent.' Or, in speaking of his endings, a term we chess experts use to designate the last part of our game, to murmur modestly, 'The endings I have already played very well, and to my mind had attained the high standard for which they were in the future to be well known.' Mr. Capablanca will have to watch that false modesty of his. It will get him into trouble some day." Although this column makes no pretense of carrying sporting news, it seems only right to print a part of the running story of the big game between Capablanca and Dr. O.S. Bernstein in the San Sebastian tournament of 1911. Capablanca wore the white, while Dr. Bernstein upheld the honor of the black. The tense moment of the game had been reached. Capablanca has the ball on Dr. Bernstein's 3-yard line on the second down, with a minute and a half to play. The stands are wild. Cries of "Hold 'em, Bernstein!" and "Touchdown, Capablanca!" ring out on the frosty November air. Brave voices are singing the fighting song entitled "Capablanca's Day," which runs as follows.
Oh, sweep, sweep across the board with your castles, queens, and pawns. We are with you all, Havana's horde, till the sun of victory dawns. Then it's fight, fight, fight to your last white knight, for the truth must win alway. And our hearts beat true, old JR, for you on Capablanca's day.
Up to this point, the game had proceeded along the lines generally recommended by the masters, writes Capablanca. The last move, however, is a slight deviation from the regular course, which brings this knight back to B in order to leave open the diagonal for the queen, and besides, is more in accordance with the defensive nature of the game. Much more could be said as to the reasons that make knight to bishop the preferred move of most masters. Of course, lest there be some misapprehension, let me state that the move knight to bishop is made in conjunction with king's rook to king, which comes first. It is lucky that Mr. Casablanca made that explanation, for I was being seized with just that misapprehension which he feared. Mr. Capablanca, I mean. Below is the box score by innings. 1, pawn to king 4. Pawn to king 4. 2, knight to queen's bishop 3. Knight to queen's bishop 3. 3, pawn to bishop 4. Pawn takes pawn. 4, knight to bishop 3. Pawn to king's knight 4. Game called on account of darkness. Chapter 38, Rip Van Winkle. After all, there is nothing like a good folk opera for wholesome fun, and the boy who can turn out a rollicking folk opera for old and young is Percy MacKaye. His latest is a riot from start to finish. You can buy it in book form, published by Knopp. Just ask for Rip Van Winkle, and spend the evening falling out of your chair. You wake up just as soon as you fall, and are all ready again for a fresh start. Of course, it is a little rough in spots, but you know what Percy MacKaye is when he gets loose on a folk opera. It is good, clean, revelation fun, such as was in Washington, The Man Who Made Us. I always felt that it was very prudish of the police to stop that play just as it was commencing its run. Or maybe it wasn't the police that stopped it. Something did, I remember. But Rip Van Winkle has much more zip to it than Washington had. In the first place, the lyrics are better. They have more of a lilt to them than the lines of the earlier work had. Here is the song hit of the first act, sung by the Goose Girl. Try this over on your piano.
Catterskill, cloud on the catterskill, will it be fair or lower? Silver rings on my pond I see, and my gander he shook both his white wings like a sunshine shower.
I venture to say that Irving Berlin himself couldn't have done anything catchier than that by way of a lyric. Or this little snatch of a refrain sung by the old women of the town.
Nay, 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 a sunshine shower won't last half an hour.
The trouble with most lyrics is that they are written by songwriters who have had no education. Mr. MacKaye's college training shows itself in every line of the opera. There is a subtlety of rhyme scheme, a delicacy of meter, and above all, an originality of thought and expression which promises much for the school of university-bred lyricists. Here, for instance, is a lyric which Joe McCarthy could never have written.
Up spoke Nancy, spanking Nancy, says my feet are far too dancy, dancy-o. So foot on the grass is my fancy-o.
Of course, this is a folk opera, and you can get away with a great deal of that Danzio stuff when you call it a folk opera. You can throw it all back on the old folk at home, and they can't say a word. But even the local wits of Rip Van Winkle's time would have repudiated the comedy lines which Mr. McKay gives to Rip to say, in which Katie did and Katie didn't figure prominently as the nub, followed, before you have time to stop laughing, by one about whip poor Will. Whip poor Will. Get it? If Rip Van Winkle is ever produced again, Ed Wynn should be cast as Rip. He would eat that line alive. Ed Wynn, by the way, might do wonders by the opera if he could get the rights to produce it in his own way. Let Mr. McKay's name stay on the program, but give Ed Wynn the white card to do as he might see fit with the book. For instance, one of Mr. McKay's characters is named Dirk Spruitenturbo. Let him stand as he is, but give him two cousins, Mynheer Junkers and Jan 183rd Street. The three of them could do a comedy tumbling act. There is practically no end to the features that could be introduced to tone the thing up. The basic idea of Rip Van Winkle would lend itself admirably to Broadway treatment, for Mr. McKay has taken liberties with the legend and introduced the topical idea of a magic flask containing a homemade hooch. Hendrick Hudson, the captain of the Catskill bowling team, is the lucky possessor of the doctor's prescription and formula, and it is in order to take a trial spin with the brew that Rip first goes up to the mountain. Here are Hendrick's very words of invitation.
"You'll be right welcome. I will let you taste a wonder drink we brew aboard the Half Moon. Whoever drinks the magic flask thereof forgets all lapse of time and wanders ever in the fairy season of youth and spring. Come, join me in the mountains at mid of night, and there I promise you the magic flask."
And so, at mid of night, Rip fell for the promise of wandering in the fairy season, as so many have done at the invitation of a man who has made a little something at home which you couldn't tell from the real stuff. Rip got out of it easily. He simply went to sleep for 20 years. You ought to see a man I know. There is a note in the front of the volume saying that no public reading of Rip Van Winkle may be given without first getting the author's permission. It ought to be made much more difficult to do than that.
Chapter 39, Literary Lost and Found Department, with scant apology to the book section of the New York Times.
Old Black Tilly, H.G.L., when I was a little girl, my nurse used to recite a poem something like the following, as near as I can remember. I wonder if anyone can give me the missing lines. Old Black Tilly lived in the dell, hi-ho with a rum-tum-tum. Something, something, something like a lot of hell, hi-ho with a rum-tum-tum. She wasn't very something, and she wasn't very fat, but...
Victor Hugo's death. M.K.C.
Is it true that Victor Hugo did not die, but is still living in a little shack in Colorado?
I'm sorry that I spelt the word. J.R.A.
Can anyone help me out by furnishing the last three words to the following stanza, which I learned in school, and of which I have forgotten the last three words, thereby driving myself crazy? I'm sorry that I spelt the word. I hate to go above you, because, the brown eyes lower fell, because you see... blank, blank, blank. God's in his heaven. J.A.E. Where did Mark Twain write the following? God's in his heaven, all's right with the world. She dwelt beside. N.K.Y. Can someone locate this for me and tell the author? She dwelt among untrodden ways, beside the springs of Dove. To me she gave sweet charity, but greater far is love. The Golden Wedding, KLF. Who wrote the following, and what does it mean? O de Golden Wedding, O de Golden Wedding, O de Golden Wedding, de Golden Golden Wedding. Answers. When Grandma was a girl, Luther F. Neem, Flushing, Long Island. The poem asked for by E.J.K. was recited at a Free Soil riot in Ashburg, Kansas, in July 1850. It was entitled, And That's the Way They Did It When Grandma Was a Girl, and was written by Bishop Leander B. Rizzard. The last line runs, And that's the way they did it when Grandma was a girl. Others who answered this query were Lillian W. East of Albany, Martin B. Forsch, New York City, and Henry Cabot Lodge, Nahant. Let us then be up and doing. Roger F. Nilkett, Presto, New Jersey, replying to the query in your last issue concerning the origin of the lines, Let us then be up and doing with a heart for any fate, still achieving, still pursuing, learn to labor and to wait. I remember hearing these lines read at a gathering in the Second Baptist Church of Presto, New Jersey, when I was a young man, by the Reverend Harley N. Ankle. It was said at the time among his parishioners that he himself wrote them, and on being questioned on the matter he did not deny it, simply smiling and saying, I'm glad if you liked them. They were henceforth known in Presto as Dr. Ankle's Verse, and were set to music and sung at his funeral. The December Bride, or Old Robin. Charles B. Rennett, Boston, New Hampshire. The whole poem wanted by H.J.O. is as follows, and appeared in Hostetter's Annual in 1843. 'Twas in the bleak December that I took her for my bride. How well do I remember how she fluttered by my side. My Nellie dear, it was not long before you up and died, and they buried her at 8:30 in the morning. Oh, do not tell me of the charms of maidens far and near. Their charming ways and manners I do not care to hear, for Lucy dear was to me so very, very dear, and they buried her at 8:30 in the morning. Then it's merrily, merrily, merrily woe, to the old gray church they come and go, some to be married and some to be buried, and old Robin has gone for the mail. The Old King's Joke, F.J. Bruff, Hammock, Connecticut. In a recent issue of your paper, Lillian F. Grothman asked for the remainder of a poem which began, The King of Sweden Made a Joke, Ha Ha. I can furnish all of this poem, having written it myself, for which I was expelled from St. Domino's School in 1895. If Miss Grothman will meet me in the green room at the Biltmore for tea on Wednesday next at 4:30, she will be supplied with the missing words. Chapter 40, Dark Water. We have so many, many problems in America. Books are constantly being written offering solutions for them, but still they persist. There are volumes on auction bridge, family budgets, and mind training. A great many people have ideas on what should be done to relieve the country of certain undesirable persons who have displayed a lack of sympathy with American institutions, as if American institutions needed sympathy. And some of the more generous-minded among us are writing books showing our duty to the struggling young nationalities of Europe. It is bewildering to be confronted by all these problems, each demanding intelligent solution. Little wonder, then, that we have no time for writing books
on the one problem which is exclusively our own. With so many wrongs in the world to be righted, who can blame us for overlooking the one tragic wrong which lies at our door? With so many heathen to whom the word of God must be brought, and so many wild revolutionists in whom must be instilled a respect for law and order, is it strange that we should ourselves sometimes lump the word of God and the principles of law and order together under the head of sentimentality and shrug our shoulders? Justice in the abstract is our aim. Any American will tell you that. So why haggle over details and insist on justice for the Negro? But W.E.B. Du Bois does insist on justice for the Negro, and in his book Darkwater, Harcourt Brace and Company, his voice rings out in a bitter warning through the complacent quiet which usually reigns around this problem of America. Mr. Du Bois seems to forget that we have the affairs of a great many people to attend to, and persists in calling our attention to this affair of our own. And what is worse, in the minds of all well-bred persons, he does not do it at all politely. He seems to be quite distressed about something. Maybe it is because he finds himself, a man of superior mind and of sensitive spirit, who is a graduate of Harvard, a professor, and a sincere worker for the betterment of mankind, relegated to an inferior order by many men and women who are obviously his inferiors, simply because he happens to differ from them in the color of his skin. Maybe it is because he sees the people of his own race who have not had his advantages, if a Negro may ever be said to have received an advantage, being crowded into an ignominious spiritual serfdom equally as bad as the physical serfdom from which they were so recently freed. Maybe it is because of these things that Mr. Du Bois seems overwrought. Or perhaps it is because he reads each day of how jealous we are, as a nation, of the sanctity of our Constitution, how we revere it and draw a flashing sword against its detractors, and then sees this very Constitution being flouted as a matter of course in those districts where the amendment giving the Negroes a right to vote is popularly considered one of the five funniest jokes in the world. Perhaps he hears candidates for office insisting on a reign of law or a plea for order above all things by some sentimentalist or other, or public speakers advising those who have not respect for American institutions to go back whence they came, and then sees whole sections of the country violating every principle of law and order and mocking American institutions for the sake of teaching a nigger his place. Perhaps, during the war, he heard of the bloody crimes of our enemies, and saw preachers and editors and statesmen stand aghast at the barbaric atrocities which won for the German the name of Hun, and then looked towards his own people, and saw them being burned, disemboweled, and tortured with a civic unanimity and tacit legal sanction, which made the word Hun sound weak. Perhaps he has heard it boasted that in America every man who is honest, industrious, and intelligent has a good chance to win out, and has seen honest, industrious, and intelligent men whose skins are black stop short by a wall so high and so thick that all they can do on having reached that far is to bow their heads and go slowly back. Any one of these reasons should have been sufficient for having written Darkwater. It is unfortunate that Mr. Du Bois should have raised this question of our own responsibility just at this time when we were showing off so nicely. It may remind someone that instead of taking over a protectorate of Armenia, we might better take over a protectorate of the state of Georgia, which yearly leads the proud list of lynchers. But then, there will not be enough people who see Mr. Du Bois's book to cause any great national movement. So we are quite sure, for the time being, of being able to devote our energies to the solution of our other problems. Don't forget, therefore, to write your congressman about a universal daylight saving bill, and give a little thought, if you can, to the question of the vehicular tunnel. This concludes Part 8 of Love Conquers All by Robert C. Benchley, read by Ted DeLorme for LibriVox. This book will continue on future files.